My question was inspired by a talk that we all listened to from Mark Forman. And in it, he described a way of understanding dehumanization as the partial view of another human. And it made me think of you, because of the experience between all of us who read you and what it is to be you. So my question is, what's your experience of being dehumanized?
Yes. Part of, or one of the ways that I got interested in this was, although I studied a lot of people, I came out of the 60s, and which actually was a very exciting time of intellectual fervent. We had not only the beginning rise of the pluralistic, you know, postmodern, post-structuralist theories that were coming into being, but we also had this whole influx of not just Eastern teachers of contemplation, which was important, but we had an influx of humanistic theorists from the continent. And these were some of the really great, great, great theorists of the human condition. So they were ones like Heidegger and Husserl and Marcel and, of course, the whole psychoanalytic movement and the variations that came off of that. And I could go on, but the interesting thing about all of them, because they're not looked at this way, but the interesting way that Freud and Marx and the Frankfurt School and Binswanger and all of these theorists of the human condition, what they were really looking at is, why do humans suffer? What is the cause of human suffering? And this is coming in the wake of Auschwitz. So they're sitting right there looking at that issue of, what is dehumanization? Why do people do it? What is the cause? And for a decade or two, that was one of the main issues that was there. And so even Freud, with somebody like Norman O'Brown, was interpreted as saying human beings, human adults, are suffering. They are constricted. There's something that's broken in them. And what is that? You know, we want to try to understand what that is. There is the whole movement during that period of what can only be called sort of the best of the occult. There was Anton Mesmer and hypnosis that we still call mesmerism in some cases. Freud had found, when he asked his patients to free associate, that under what he called secondary thinking, which was rational, conventional, conformist, normal, and so on, if people just sort of free associated longer and longer and longer, they kind of lost orientation and found themselves in this realm of fantasy and images and luminosities. And Freud called that primary process. And he came to think eventually that it's in this primary process that the difficulty with human beings arises. And he eventually called the primary process the libido, the energy, and it was the libido, and the primary process itself he called the id. The id, incidentally, is a term that Freud never used. He used literally the pronoun, the it. And so he would write, you know, it's a, we see pressure from the id coming up on the person now. He would write literally, we see pressure from the it coming up on the person. Because he would say, if you look inside yourself now, you'll find some things that are under control. And those he called the ego. But he didn't use the term ego. He used the term the I. So those are under control of the I, but other aspects of our mind we find are not. Those are under control of the it. So we have these two areas, it and I. And human beings are unfree because they have split these apart. And so he was asked, what's the goal of psychoanalysis? And he said in the real German, using sort of the real pronouns, well, the way it's usually translated is, he answered, that where it was, their ego shall be. But what he really wrote was, where it was, their I shall become. So it was things like the anxiety, it's stronger than I am. The desire to eat, it's a compulsion that I don't have any control over, so on and so on. So the idea was to move the I into, take responsibility for the it, reintegrate it, and move forward. At that time, there was a huge argument about what this primary process was that this it came out of. And Freud himself got the term the it from a book by George Grotek called The Book of the It. And Grotek got it from Taoism. The it was the Tao. So it's like, wow, where that was, let Tao be, you know, was really one of the things that's being said. But the argument was over what was in this it and how to approach it. And at that time, Carl Jung had been, by Freud, named Freud's crown prince and successor, as Freud put it. So Jung was really meant to inherit the whole psychoanalytic tradition, Freud being some 20 or 30 years older. And one of the last, well, the last conversation they had, when it was sort of an understanding that this was a conversation about what I want you to do when I die, how I want you to carry on the goal of psychoanalysis. And he said, above all else, you must not give up the libido theory, the it theory. And Jung said, well, why? And Freud said, because it protects us from the black tides of the mud of occultism. And Jung's face kind of dropped over because he said, that occultism was basically everything I was interested in. And so I'm supposed to, you know, push that away. All of these things came in the light of dehumanization, of what it is to suffer, what it is to be subject to a being in the world that is indeed inhuman. And so I think that's kind of an important thing to remember, because it's sort of sometimes thought that the Eastern traditions and the Bodhisattva and so on are the ones that only are concerned with, you know, doing these paths of training for all sentient beings. But it's a very, very strong component of that in Western therapeutic traditions. And of course, the whole study of the libido showed up in all sorts of areas, including art, where it was responsible for surrealism. And the surrealists would try to get in touch with different techniques with their libido. And that was thought to be liberating. That was thought to be something that's coming out. When I started writing, I just basically had an enormous respect for these individuals, and particularly some of the existentialists that were just brilliant, brilliant writers, and phenomenologists, and so on. And I was actually very glad when I moved into California that I ended up living in the same county as Rollo May, who is probably the greatest American existential writer. And so books that I did, like Up from Eden, it actually gave a couple of questions at the beginning. And it said, what I want to look at is, why do human beings suffer? What forms of suffering does that take? And why, ultimately, do they manufacture these forms of suffering as a way, a tempted way, to become free? So it was an example of the whole dehumanization process and ultimately how humans do that to themselves, the things they do to create those inhuman conditions. More often than not, thinking there's something good. And that's what I found so fascinating about it. And, you know, we all know the cliche, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Or Hannah Arendt's The Banality of Evil. Or Hobbes, in order for evil to triumph, it is only necessary that good men and women do nothing. And all of those were sort of circled around again and again and again after each chapter. The thing that I find fascinating and somewhat disturbing is that after all of that questioning and after all of that inquiry, we still have huge sections of this country and the world that live under dehumanized conditions. And we don't somehow seem to care. It doesn't seem quite to be something that concerns us as much as it did. And I personally find that really sorrowful, because that whole era of when you talked about that, when it was a concern, when it was something that you would have breakfast over and discuss, it seems to me we've lost something there, and that our intellectual debate and discussion has itself been dehumanized. We don't talk about really important issues that often. And I find that, you know, really disturbing, basically. And then because I find myself not doing as much. I still do it, but not as much, because the audience is so thin for that type of talk. It's going to have to circle around and come back, because it's still a major issue, and a major issue that I haven't seen, you know, fundamentally addressed at this point. Does that get close at all? Do you want to know how it affected me?
Yes.
Well, there are so many sort of different angles from it. In terms of sort of just the sheer Marxist economic view, the 10 years that I spent in Lincoln washing dishes was as economically dehumanizing as I can think of. You are on the bottom of the totem pole in a restaurant when you are the dishwasher. At the same time, it was an extremely important lesson for me. And in a sense, fortunately, I was doing Zen at the time. And Zen had the notion of, you know, just simple kitchen work is the best you can do. So I had that in the back of my mind, and I sort of, you know, gave it a boost along. And then as finances became less an issue, what took its place was just the simple fact that it wasn't a topic of discussion anymore. Rollo May died, and most of the great existential humanistic thinkers died. The Journal of Humanistic Psychology took a huge dip in its circulation. And I was surprised to learn right before it did that I had actually published more articles in that journal than anybody else. including the European existentialists. So I was surprised just a little bit to learn how much it meant to me. And that is still an issue and still something that is very bothersome to me. And I feel guilty about it because I say that, but I don't do anything about it. And that bothers me. And I don't do anything about that. So it's like I had a period of my life that I went through that it was absolutely important. And then just the sheer, this is getting nowhere-ness of it, shift my concerns to where I thought maybe I could do something more, get more traction about it. And I find it a topic not even raised in the academic journals, really, of this country. And I think that's just sad.